Državni ispitni center.
Maturità generale 2015.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi a un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna a sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Kelvin Boot about rats. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
It's often said that humans are the most successful mammal because of our adaptability to different climates and habitats, which allows us to live on every continent except in the heart of Antarctica. Well, wherever we have travelled, rats have come too, adapting as readily as us to all our habitats, living in grain stores, rubbish tips, houses, barns, and always on ships. And when these ships docked, some of the stowaways invariably disembarked along with the cargo and set up new colonies. More often than not, this quickly proved to be a problem, and not just to humans, because ground-nesting birds, for example, are amongst the first to suffer, as the eggs and live chicks are easy meals. So can we, should we indeed, try to get rid of rats from the areas where they're doing most damage? With me are Professor Mick Clout from the University of Auckland in New Zealand and Kelvin Boot, the Shared Planet correspondent. Kelvin, just how much of a problem are rats?
Well, let's be clear for a start. There are four species of rats that are involved in the problems that we're facing. There's the brown rat, which is our common rat. That's the one we know. There's the black rat, which is the one that's largely associated with carrying the plague. And then there are two others, the Polynesian rat, which is particularly relevant on offshore islands. And a poor fourth, but nevertheless still having an impact, is the Asian house rat. They're all commensals. Now, commensal is a technical term, really, for what you might regard as the poor man living off the rich man's table. So we're the rich men and the rat is living off us. And wherever we have gone, the rat has followed. Quite often when they go into offshore islands as invasive species, they don't have a natural predator. They have a prodigious reproductive rate. And so when they're left with free rein, with nothing to control them, within just a few weeks of being born, they can reproduce and they carry on throughout the year. Start with one rat. Before you know it, you've got hundreds, thousands, millions of rats in some of these places. So they can be a massive problem, particularly for ground nesting birds and other mammals, because they just go in and they're voracious predators. They become the top predator on the islands.
So once you give them an inch, they invariably take a mile, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And if you look on a global map of where these infestations have taken place, pretty well every island has got it. We can do something. And eradication programs over the last few decades have been put into place. And the idea there is to take out every single rat on the island so they become rat free. And these have been really quite successful. And if you look at the whole range of these, something like 90% of rat eradication programs have actually worked on these islands. And that's a lot. That's something like 709 rat eradication programs have worked.
Does it harm any other species in the process, though?
Yes, there are still and have been quite a lot of cases where native wildlife, particularly birds of prey, that are picking up the dead rats or the sickly rats. One good example of that, or bad example of it, is Rat Island, which is in the Aleutians off the coast of Alaska, where 46 bald eagles died. I mean, there are only 22 bald eagles known on that island, and they just happen to coincide with the migration season for the bald eagles and indeed other birds as well. So quite a big toll, but a toll which the conservation organisations seem to think is worth paying for getting the native wildlife back to where it was in the first place.
So it does seem that at any level it's a big job.
Now you will hear the recording again.
It's often said that humans are the most successful mammal because of our adaptability to different climates and habitats, which allows us to live on every continent except in the heart of Antarctica. Well, wherever we have travelled, rats have come too, adapting as readily as us to all our habitats, living in grain stores, rubbish tips, houses, barns, and always on ships. And when these ships docked, some of the stowaways invariably disembarked along with the cargo and set up new colonies. More often than not, this quickly proved to be a problem, and not just to humans, because ground-nesting birds, for example, are amongst the first to suffer, as the eggs and live chicks are easy meals. So can we, should we indeed, try to get rid of rats from the areas where they're doing most damage? With me are Professor Mick Clout from the University of Auckland in New Zealand and Kelvin Boot, the Shared Planet correspondent. Kelvin, just how much of a problem are rats?
Well, let's be clear for a start. There are four species of rats that are involved in the problems that we're facing. There's the brown rat, which is our common rat. That's the one we know. There's the black rat, which is the one that's largely associated with carrying the plague. And then there are two others, the Polynesian rat, which is particularly relevant on offshore islands, and a poor fourth, but nevertheless still having an impact, is the Asian house rat. They're all commensals. Now, commensal is a technical term, really, for what you might regard as the poor man living off the rich man's table. So we're the rich men and the rat is living off us. And wherever we have gone, the rat has followed. Quite often when they go into offshore islands as invasive species, they don't have a natural predator. They have a prodigious reproductive rate. And so when they're left with free rein, with nothing to control them, within just a few weeks of being born, they can reproduce and they carry on throughout the year. Start with one rat. Before you know it, you've got hundreds, thousands, millions of rats in some of these places. So they can be a massive problem, particularly for ground nesting birds and other mammals, because they just go in and they're voracious predators. They become the top predator on the islands.
So once you give them an inch, they invariably take a mile, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And if you look on a global map of where these infestations have taken place, pretty well every island has got it. We can do something. And eradication programs over the last few decades have been put into place. And the idea there is to take out every single rat on the island so they become rat free. And these have been really quite successful. And if you look at the whole range of these, something like 90% of rat eradication programs have actually worked on these islands. And that's a lot. That's something like 709 rat eradication programs have worked.
Does it harm any other species in the process, though?
Yes, there are still and have been quite a lot of cases where native wildlife, particularly birds of prey that are picking up the dead rats or the sickly rats. One good example of that, or bad example of it, is Rat Island, which is in the Aleutians off the coast of Alaska, where 46 bald eagles died. I mean, there are only 22 bald eagles known on that island, and they just happened to coincide with the migration season for the bald eagles and indeed other birds as well. So quite a big toll, but a toll which the conservation organisations seem to think is worth paying for getting the native wildlife back to where it was in the first place.
So it does seem that at any level it's a big job.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Meg Testerman, a librarian, about Ernest Hemingway. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
The great 20th century American writer, Ernest Hemingway, spent one of the last summers of his life in Spain. It was 1959 and became known as the Dangerous Summer. The Kennedy Library in Boston had a catalog of photographs of Ernest Hemingway from 1953 all the way up to that summer. Librarian Meg Testerman recently undertook the daunting task of sorting through these thousands of photographs. She attempted to track down information about the people and places in the images. And remember, this was before things like Facebook tags. So Meg Testerman, Hemingway knew Spain pretty well. He was there during the Spanish Civil War and spent a lot of time documenting it. What made him go back?
Well, in 59, he went to Spain to document the rivalry of two bullfighters for Life magazine. He had a contract. And I always thought this was quite clever of Hemingway because these two bullfighters were good friends of his. And so I thought that was quite smart that he managed to get Life to pay for his whole summer driving around Spain
really?
And watching bullfights and hanging out with his friends.
Now, this is Franco, Spain in 1959. Couldn't have been a terribly pleasant place to live. And yet all these pictures look so glorious.
They do. These pictures are from a very kind of privileged perspective. Hemingway himself is staying at a villa that has a pool and gardens, and they're having luncheons on the balcony. Hemingway was really well known in Spain at that time, and of course the bullfighters are their national heroes, so they were getting quite the life that summer.
So those two bullfighters that he profiled for Life and then in his novel The Dangerous Summer, he apparently became quite close to these bullfighters. What do you think the images tell us about life in Spain for these matadors?
They had many funny stories from that summer. They playfully kidnapped two American school teachers from Pamplona. They dressed up A.E. Hotchner, who's Hemingway's friend and editor. They dressed him up as a matador and sent him to the bull ring as Antonio and Luis Miguel's substitute bullfighter. If one of them were to be injured, he would have to go in and kill the bull. We have a couple photographs of that.
So as you research these pictures, I mean, there's some extraordinary ones. I mean, everybody seems to be chilling out and having a good time. And what was the coolest aha moment in your investigating these pictures?
One of the strange things about archives is that you look at these people over and over, especially if they're ones that you're trying to figure out who they are, and you kind of get a sense of who they are through the photographs. You kind of see their character and their personality, but it's also bittersweet because as you're getting to know them, oftentimes these people have already died, so you also know how their story ends. And this was very true of all of Hemingway's pictures because just 2 years later, he was already dead. And all these pictures kind of show that he's having a great time. This is the last good summer of his life. There are pool parties. He's traveling around with bullfighters. He's having a great time. But in the back of my mind, I always knew what was the suffering that he was going to endure.
And one must imagine that his wife, Mary Welsh, was somehow aware of where this depression was heading. One of the pictures is of a birthday party that she threw for him. Can you describe that image for us? And is there anything in there that you detect kind of peering into the future a bit of Hemingway's life?
The birthday party is a really fun story. Mary, of course, threw this elaborate party for him. She had fireworks. She had donkey rides. They had a carnival shooting gallery set up. There's a story about the next morning, how someone had kind of touched his hair funny and he had just kind of snapped. And I think this was one of these moments where people were, his friends, his close friends and his family were starting to realize that something wasn't quite right with him, that he was starting to be a little bit more sensitive than he had been.
Now you will hear the recording again.
The great 20th century American writer, Ernest Hemingway, spent one of the last summers of his life in Spain. It was 1959 and became known as the Dangerous Summer. The Kennedy Library in Boston had a catalog of photographs of Ernest Hemingway from 1953 all the way up to that summer. Librarian Meg Testerman recently undertook the daunting task of sorting through these thousands of photographs. She attempted to track down information about the people and places in the images. And remember, this was before things like Facebook tags. So Meg Testerman, Hemingway knew Spain pretty well. He was there during the Spanish Civil War and spent a lot of time documenting it. What made him go back?
Well, in 59, he went to Spain to document the rivalry of two bullfighters for Life magazine. He had a contract. And I always thought this was quite clever of Hemingway because these two bullfighters were good friends of his. And so I thought that was quite smart that he managed to get Life to pay for his whole summer driving around Spain
really?
And watching bullfights and hanging out with his friends.
Now, this is Franco, Spain in 1959. Couldn't have been a terribly pleasant place to live. And yet all these pictures look so glorious.
They do. These pictures are from a very kind of privileged perspective. Hemingway himself is staying at a villa that has a pool and gardens, and they're having luncheons on the balcony. Hemingway was really well known in Spain at that time, and of course the bullfighters are their national heroes, so they were getting quite the life that summer.
So those two bullfighters that he profiled for Life and then in his novel The Dangerous Summer, he apparently became quite close to these bullfighters. What do you think the images tell us about life in Spain for these matadors?
They had many funny stories from that summer. They playfully kidnapped two American school teachers from Pamplona. They dressed up A.E. Hotchner, who's Hemingway's friend and editor. They dressed him up as a matador and sent him to the bullring as Antonio and Luis Miguel's substitute bullfighter. If one of them were to be injured, he would have to go in and kill the bull. We have a couple photographs of that.
So as you research these pictures, I mean, there's some extraordinary ones. I mean, everybody seems to be chilling out and having a good time. And what was the coolest aha moment in your investigating these pictures?
One of the strange things about archives is that you look at these people over and over, especially if they're ones that you're trying to figure out who they are, and you kind of get a sense of who they are through the photographs. You kind of see their character and their personality, but it's also bittersweet because as you're getting to know them, oftentimes these people have already died, so you also know how their story ends. And this was very true of all of Hemingway's pictures because just 2 years later, he was already dead. And all these pictures kind of show that he's having a great time. This is the last good summer of his life. There are pool parties. He's traveling around with bullfighters. He's having a great time. But in the back of my mind, I always knew what was the suffering that he was going to endure.
And one must imagine that his wife, Mary Welsh, was somehow aware of where this depression was heading. One of the pictures is of a birthday party that she threw for him. Can you describe that image for us? And is there anything in there that you detect kind of peering into the future a bit of Hemingway's life?
The birthday party is a really fun story. Mary, of course, threw this elaborate party for him. She had fireworks. She had donkey rides. They had a carnival shooting gallery set up. There's a story about the next morning, how someone had kind of touched his hair funny and he had just kind of snapped. And I think this was one of these moments where people were, his friends, his close friends and his family were starting to realize that something wasn't quite right with him, that he was starting to be a little bit more sensitive than he had been.
This is the end of section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.